Totally Football Show. Hails to the bells, it's the emotional roller coaster that is International Week. As the big names line up for some exciting international challenges, like filling the next 60 minutes, we run down where your nation is on the road to next summer's European Championships. Bicycles to Van Basten. Why Friday's Germany-Netherlands game might be the greatest European fixture. Plus, hits and misses with the new Women's Super League season, the nice folks in the Côte d'Ivoire explaining racism, and the return of the flip reverse in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Who's on board? You are, listener. Thank goodness for that. And here to talk to you, straight out of Loughborough, it's Daniel Storey, writer for The Eye.
Good morning.
Lindsay Hooper from The Offside Rule.
Hello.
And many other places, Lindsay.
Well,
define you.
Many, but we don't need to list them all.
Okay. Michael Cox is here, man of words, man of letters.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Thanks. Yeah, they're component parts. Yeah,
yeah,
thanks.
Absolutely. And they, and you put some of them together in strings, we call sentences, to make books called things like Mixer and Zonal Marking, which you can pay for with money and enjoy.
That's all true. Thanks, James.
Can
brilliant.
Can you pay with Bitcoin?
Not as far as I'm aware, but I don't really know what Bitcoin is, to be honest. So.
Somebody told me, and this is completely irrelevant, but somebody told me that the servers that power the whole Bitcoin economy use up more energy per day than all the flights that go on around the world. Wow. I don't know if that's true. I found it shocking.
That somehow makes me understand Bitcoin less than I did before.
All right.
Yeah, me too.
Let's move on to things that we do have some passing understanding of, Daniel. Things like football, things like the end of the transfer window, which came to a shuddering stop at the conclusion of Monday. First up, how much fun does Icardi to PSG look?
I think it looks potentially disastrous. So yes, very, very fun.
Right. There's the character issue of bringing in a player who's just been a massive disruption in one dressing room to a dressing room that's already massively disrupted. But there's also the fact that he hasn't actually played a game in how long now?
Quite a while. I don't know when.
So bringing him in as cover for a couple of injured players, how much sense does that make?
Well, none. And also bringing him into a dressing room with a disgruntled Neymar, who's now still there. I mean, I wouldn't want them both in my dressing room as a player.
And I'm not sure that there's a place for him when everyone's fit. I mean, he's a very, quite a one-dimensional forward, isn't he, Icardi? He's a goal poacher, essentially. Mm. He's not someone who's going to be involved in build-up play. And I think, I mean, they have enough goals, don't they? It's just a strange signing. Everything about it's odd.
They have got Real Madrid coming up in the Champions League and Cavani and Mbappe out, but I guess there's some logic. Can you see why they would have done it? Is there a way that you think it could work out, Michael?
I think he'll score goals in Ligue 1.
Okay.
Because they do create chances and he is a very good finisher. But, I mean, what PSG's task is not to score more goals in Ligue 1, it's to progress in the Champions League. And I'm not convinced he's the style of player that will give them more.
Okay.
Because he is the kind of player you just don't see for 70 minutes and then scores two goals. But whether he'll do that in the Champions League, we'll have to wait and see.
Okay. Nicholas Bentner might score goals in Ligue 1. He's, though, just signed for his hometown club, FC Copenhagen, until the end of the season. Great footage of his first training session. Daniel, you've seen that.
Yeah, it's very rare that you watch anything done by a footballer and think, I think I could have done better there. There's one header where he really blasts it and the ball just goes out a side shot. Doesn't even trouble the goal. It's amazing.
He is the gift that keeps on giving, isn't he?
Well, apparently just for one more season.
Yeah,
so.
Well, I'm going to miss him. I'm really going to miss him when he retires.
Right. Which is appropriate, you know, given his track record in that training. Elsewhere, though, the big news, and Gabriele Marcotti did a lovely article about this on ESPN, was the dogs that didn't bark in the night, the players who didn't move, Neymar, Pogba, Dybala, Eriksen, Zaha. Do you think this was just a blip? Gab is kind of positing that the FFP regulations mean that all the big players have ended up at all the big clubs. No one else can afford them, but now the big clubs got too many.
And maybe that's true for the transfer window as a whole. I think for deadline day, I mean, most deadline days, nothing happens. It's all complete speculation at the start of the day. There's always about 10 transfers that have about 2% chance of happening, and then nothing happens. When you look through deadline day, there's been maybe three in the last 10 years where there's been big transfers. But usually, if you're asking the question a week out, do you think so-and-so will happen?
Yeah.
The answer is usually no, isn't it?
But over the course of the summer, I think that those were moves. I think you'd have expected at least some of those to go through, whether it was Eriksen or certainly Neymar. But hey.
And the bigger story off the back of things that as well have been happening in Italy this week is the fact that one player, Yannick Bolasie at Everton, didn't make a move to a club where he might experience racism from the fans, and that was CSKA Moscow, who did come in for him. But he didn't want to do that move because of that reason. And I think, wow, when we're in a world where we're talking about that, and also it's topical after Cagliari as well, I think his story is one that we should be focusing on.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk a bit more about Inter later on, but I must admit, I hadn't seen that. It's really, really sad. Elsewhere, the last week's news that Bolton had been rescued saw them embark on an absolutely mad transfer deadline day flurry to actually make a team with which to pursue the rest of the season.
Yeah, they are particularly useful for clubs like Nottingham Forest, who have stockpiled players and managed to get three to Bolton out on deadline day.
How difficult was it what Bolton had to do on Monday?
In a way, it wasn't that difficult in that any player that said yes to them, they basically had to say yes to that player. The interesting thing, I think, is if you're a club that is yet to play Bolton and seen, for example, Tranmere beating them 5-0, you then play them in 2 weeks' time and they've suddenly got a team packed with Championship players, admittedly that the Championship clubs didn't want, but it's a stronger team now. You'd be annoyed if you missed out on the playoffs or got relegated on goal difference at the end of the season. You had to play Bolton when they were good rather than when they were, you know, absolutely terrible. I think I really feel for those clubs.
Right. Although I suppose that's an issue whenever you have the transfer window closing once the season's underway.
Particularly with Bolton, because they were banned from signing players and then were suddenly allowed. Yeah.
This issue, though, of the Premier League stopping their transfers, or at least stopping acquisitions, 2 weeks before the rest of the continent, did that prove to be as big a thing as was predicted?
No. Second season in a row, it hasn't really affected Premier League clubs at all. And it has affected Premier League clubs when you look at their lineups, because they keep on playing unchanged sides. Whereas you look 2 or 3 years ago, managers would go into the season completely unable to prepare. And I think it's really improved the standard of football in the Premier League. So I think it's a good thing.
It does.
And I realise this is not, you know, the done thing to be saying at this moment in time for wider reasons, but I think we've got it right, and I think the rest of Europe should copy us. But
unfortunately, Michael, or perhaps predictably, I understand that we're now going to do the wrong thing.
Have they
not announced that they are intending to move it back in line with Europe?
Yeah, the story is that they will vote, and the vote will be that they only need a majority, and that a majority will move it back simply because the rest of Europe hasn't fallen into line, which seems a little bit impatient, because I think it was Sid Lowe who was saying that Spain actually is considering moving into line, just not yet. And it will just take a bit of time for the clubs to agree. So it does seem a bit of a shame that they're going to... It just ruins the start of the season for me. That new season excitement is completely eclipsed by transfer noise.
So you're saying we'd be throwing away our leadership in Europe at a time, just at the time when we'd actually have a big role to play? That's interesting.
It's like the entire month, the first month of the season, I think is farcical, because you have 3 weeks where it's just constant transfer deadline. Then there's deadline day and you're like, OK, let's get going. It's the international break. It's just a waste of a month.
Well, Mauricio Pochettino wasn't happy, was he?
No.
And I've not seen him not happy in all the time that I've been covering London
Mauricio
clubs.
Pochettino?
Yeah, but he's not happy. He's not happy about this European transfer.
He's not happy quite a lot.
No, I've always found him an absolute pleasure.
The Spurs manager, Mauricio Pochettino.
Yes.
Big bloke, purple tracksuit.
One of my favourites. And I have to say that this European transfer window really seemed to get under his skin, unless there's other things going on,
which
we don't know. But having all that speculation around Christian Eriksen, and you've got players as well that their contracts are running out, like Jan Vertonghen and Toby Alderweireld. And who would have thought that the last hour, Barcelona come in, they make an approach for Lucas Moura, and then Daniel Levy saying £50 million. Could they afford to sell him at all, even if they'd have got that £50 million? I'd have argued they couldn't. Not when the way that it's set up is that ours is closed and European transfer window is still open. The amount of people that have been flocking around Spurs, I can understand why he's disgruntled. Because it does seem to have upset the status quo there.
I see. All right, well, as you say, Michael, your voice a quiver with excitement, the international break is upon us. So straight after this, we'll be looking at those games and no question what the standout fixture is.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
This Friday, listener, sees Germany facing Netherlands again. Yes, one of international football's fiercest rivalries. From the Germans beating Cruyff's Orange in the 1974 World Cup final, to Hullet and Van Basten doing the do at Euro 88, to the moment the spat really came to a head when Rijkaard flobbed on Rudi Völler's perm at Italia 90. They're always eventful games. They're often epic. As our friends Michael Jongsma and Raphael Honigstein explain in this specially commissioned Reminisci package.
Johan Cruyff, Franz Beckenbauer. Two players that they're valuing at over £1 million. Netherlands versus Deutschland in the World Cup final 1974.
The West Germans didn't realise that there was necessarily a non-football element to this game, but a lot of the Dutch players later came out and explained perhaps why they were so keen on humiliating Germany. Certainly the way the game has been retold in Germany was that the Dutch started doing lots of flicks, started to really try to anger almost the Germans, and of course they came back to win the game.
End of the game, and West Germany have won the World Cup. There's the man who did it, Gerd Müller.
With the Dutch eventually losing that final, that has been the overarching image, I suppose, of that World Cup for the Dutch. The damn Germans doing their thing again.
Van Basten, what's in the position? Not a goal for Basten!
The Dutch had a fantastic team, and the 88 Euros was most definitely a point at which they felt that they finally overcome the fear of the Germans, which was mostly personified by the current Dutch national manager, Ronald Koeman, wiping his arse with Olaf Thon's shirt after beating the Germans 2-1.
Well, now he's called Völler over. Well, Völler was provoked into that because he'd already got the free kick.
The quarterfinal in 1990, another iconic game really in Dutch-German football relations. And not just for the win and for the performance, which was really good on Germany's behalf, but also of course for the sending off for both Völler and Rijkaard.
Ruud Völler is absolutely incensed, and in fairness, well, it's a red card. And Völler is off, and that is extraordinary. Oh, and there was no doubt about it then. Rijkaard spat on Völler as he walked past him, and that, Bobby, is atrocious. Absolutely atrocious.
At that point, I think most people saw Van Rijkaard as a hero.
Germany Holland met again in 92. The worst of the sort of animosity and the hatred that spilled over in 1990 was gone by then.
That 2-2 draw in the Nations League that effectively relegated the Germans and got the Dutch to the final is still seen as a watershed moment for the Dutch in football, but also for example, for a player like Virgil van Dijk, when asked about his season, and he's had a really successful season, obviously. One of the highlights he pointed out was scoring against the Germans because it was a goal against the Germans. So that sentiment is still there. It's obviously a bit friendlier, but still, when it comes to rivalries, this is still the one that counts.
Elena's cross! Oh, they plucked it out! Would you believe it? Virgil van Dijk, in the last minute of the game, has levelled it up! And maybe Dutch will go to the Nations League party after all!
Look at this for a finish on the volley. No chance. De Neuer.
Well, the expectation is to win every single game in those qualifiers, whether it's the Dutch at home in Hamburg or Northern Ireland. It hasn't really changed. Germany feel that they should top the scoop, that they should qualify fairly comfortably. And the results almost take a backseat to the performances. That is, of course, if they do win against the Dutch. As far as Northern Ireland concerned, Germans appreciate the challenge that they pose. They saw the Euros, you know, they saw what they did then, but it's not the sort of opposition that even a Germany that is still in the process of sort of shaping up to be a real powerhouse again would feel should have too many problems with.
Fabulous stuff there. Netherlands, Germany, and Germany go again on Friday. It's actually the fourth meeting in the last year or so. The last one, which was earlier on in qualifying, saw Germany winning 3-2 in Amsterdam in March.
Mm.
That was a brilliant game. I mean, the best international game I've seen for a long time. Just non-stop action, last-minute winner from, I think, Nico Schultz for Germany. Germany played this mad 3-5-2 with Sané and Gnabry up front just running everywhere, and yeah, it's just a great historic fixture, but these fixtures have been full of goals over the last year as well.
Yeah, they have. Yeah, they really have. I mean, the last three in the 12 months have actually yielded 12 goals. Mm. And I know this more than anyone because two of my friends who are married, one is from the Netherlands and one is from Germany, and wow, they sit on different sides of the room, it feels like, when I've been with them. And I've watched World Cup football, and there's been pain there in Mao's eyes, you know, as a Netherlands fan over recent years. But there seems to be glimmers, doesn't there, that the Netherlands are back to where they once were.
Well, that victory over Germany to earn themselves a place in the prestigious Nations League final. Of course, as it stands right now, they're both chasing the mighty Northern Ireland in their Euro qualifying group. Netherlands are 6 points behind Germany, but with their game in hand, and they both got games in hand on Michael O'Neill's Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you can't say too much at the moment, can you, without you need a few more games really to sort of work out where the group is. But
okay. Leroy Sané, you mentioned scoring in that 3-2 win, and
he scored in the 2-2 draw as well, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah.
And he's not going to score in this one because he's out.
No.
That's my analysis. De Ligt and De Jong haven't started their season well. Well, De Ligt had a horror show against Napoli. Anyway, it's going to be fascinating to watch on Friday evening. Did you know that Serge Gnabry has 7 goals in his 8 caps so far?
I did not know that. That's a very good international scoring rate.
I would say so. As you point out, Lindsay, there's not that much point looking at the tables at this early stage, but this is an absolutely crucial game, though, particularly for Netherlands, lying as they do all the way down, I think, in fourth place in the group. No,
it's
third, sorry.
It's
third.
More must-win for them.
Right.
And I think that they need to assert some authority in this tie. And I think Van Dijk will help them do that, because I think he's been brilliant since that 2-2 draw, because he was instrumental, I thought, in that game, and has sort of changed in the way he's played for the Netherlands since. So I think that this could be very, very tight. But a high-scoring draw? Is anyone else thinking that?
Well, I don't know. We'll see. By the way, if you like a bit of Germany-Netherlands, get yourself along to thetotallyfootballshow.com, where Nick Miller's got a lovely retro piece on the 92 Euro meeting between these two nations. What happened back then? Spoiler alert, Michael.
So that was in the group stage. Holland won 2-0.
3-1, I think.
3-1.
Yeah.
There was quite a famous headed goal by Dennis Bergkamp in that was quite interesting. But then Holland kind of got carried away, as Holland have a tendency to do over the years, and then lost in the semi-finals to Denmark, and Germany progressed through the semi-finals and then lost to Denmark in the final.
Brilliant.
Very strange tournament, that Euro 92.
I'll say. Anyway, right. Now, so much more of that kind of thing on thetotallyfootballshow.com. What's the rest of Europe up to over this international break? We'll be finding that out next.
Paddy Power knows the very best way to sponsor a team is by unsponsoring them. That's why we're launching the Save Our Shirt campaign. And that's why Huddersfield Town's kit won't have our logo on it at all. Don't you wish we weren't on your shirt? Paddy Power, save our shirt.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media. Абе до петък карам на трета, а намерете ми някаква нормална диета. Тук до няколко дена трябва да бъда първа ракета. Смисъл, моля ви, поработете вместо мене, че аз на морето няма да мога да стана веднага барета, ма трея колата, поне да мога си кара на пета. Мани на този етап не мога излети самолета. Трета стюардеса ми вика, по-намалете капацитета. Елементарно, няма парички, няма реклами, няма турнета, няма да взема награда ни от жена ми, ни от планета.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome to Hell, England. That's Gladden by Edson Hazata, who's currently riding high in the Bulgarian charts with that track. And that's the kind of raucous reception that's going to await England this weekend from the travelling support anyway.
They're not famous for their music, are they?
In Bulgaria? Yeah. I bet they are in Bulgaria. That's such a... I'm surprised you,
Maybe
Lindsay.
In Eurovision.
But do you not think Bulgarian... Just because we've
not really
been
my cup of tea. I suppose, yeah. It's just I not don't my, know any, my area of
They
expertise.
Probably hate blue.
Possibly.
Yeah, so...
Right.
Ask Pat Nevin next time he's in.
Right. Or listener, if you're in Bulgaria or are familiar with their music and feel it's getting a short shrift unfairly.
Yeah, let me know. Let me know some good tracks to listen to, because I travel a lot to football matches. Mm. I need things to listen to in the car.
Right. I tell you one kind of Bulgarian record that's not good, and that's their record in the qualifying so far.
Lovely. Nice segue.
Yeah, because they've yet to win a game so far in qualifying. There you go. England, by contrast, thrashed the Czech Republic 5-0 and then did Montenegro 5-1. So they're looking pretty good. Any thoughts before we whiz on the England team with four uncapped players?
I think the interesting thing will be, with Wan-Bissaka out, Trent Alexander-Arnold will start, and it'll be interesting to see if Southgate tries to effectively replicate Liverpool, which I think is kind of been what he's trying to do, with Alexander-Arnold pushing really forward, Chilwell probably doing the same if he starts. Mm. And it's that midfield balance, because everyone's kind of pushing for a Mason Mount or a James Maddison. But actually, if they're going to play with fullbacks really high, what would make more sense would be a Winks, Rice and Henderson midfield. But then that doesn't get any of those two new boys in. So it'll be interesting to see.
There was this uproar about Kyle Walker not being included. And I have to say, I agree with Gareth Southgate on this. You know, in the comments that he made, he was like, what is the point of bringing him into the squad at his age, at his experience, if I'm not going to play him straight away? Mm. And were you two the same? Were you thinking that he should have been included? Because I just thought that was quite a good explanation.
We've got the Premier League champion at right back, we've got the European champion at right back, and we've got the most expensive right back in the history of English football. So we have so many options in that position. That I mean, I actually think that Wan-Bissaka pulling out this squad will negatively affect him, and he's brilliant because you have to take your chances to impress, and he probably might have started against at least one of these games. So yeah, I think Alexander-Arnold is, especially against weaker nations,
right,
let him push forward.
Wan-Bissaka, who was one of the four uncapped players called up, and Mason Mount and James Maddison also in the squad, as is Tyrone Mings, and delightful to see to tick on your England bingo sheet. I thought the call up was a wind up from Tyrone. There you go. Anyway, England, they're looking good in the group. They'd have to work pretty hard not to qualify, not least because having topped the Nations League group, that means that even if they don't finish top two, they get a playoff, blah, 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 etc. Who's your favourite Bulgarian player of all time, Lindsay?
Well, I couldn't say that they're my favourite of all time from watching them live, because right, it was before my time. But I have voiced and been part of a few productions where I have watched clips, and going back, I remember the USA 94, Hristo Stoichkov.
I met him, you know.
Incredible. I didn't actually know who it was that I'd watched. You've met him?
Yeah.
Oh, tell us more.
Well, no, it was quite intimidating. He's a very big, his presence, it fills the room.
He's a rock star, isn't he, basically?
Yeah.
Is he as feisty in real life as he was on the pitch?
He doesn't need to be, you know, because no one's going to give him any jip. So when he walks in, he's quite calm and relaxed about it because he knows, but you know it could turn in an instant. Certainly that was my impression.
When was that? Was that in his brief spell at Palmer?
He went to Palmer,
yeah. For like 8 games or something.
That's right. I got in. Got nice. Out.
There's a lovely quote from Stoichkov when he won the Ballon d'Or in 94. He just went up on the stage and said, "There are two Christs, one in heaven and one at Barcelona," and then said, "Me," as if anyone knew who he was talking about.
The tournament in 94, I remember watching quite a lot of it. I was 12, right. So spoiler alert on age coming up. But as you're trying to work that out, James, that was so rude. 12 years old, and I remember some of those goals, but I knew that I didn't know who the player was, and it wasn't until later on I voiced some footage, and I was like, oh, that was who I watched, who I really enjoyed. And then I started doing that thing of going and trawling through YouTube and watching loads of his old goals. So I loved him. I have to say Stylian Petrov, even though I'm a Wolves fan and he was huge filler, but I really liked him as a player.
Lechkov, he was my favourite from 94.
Yeah, and Trifon Ivanov, who sadly passed away in 2016.
Okay.
Did he? Yeah, he was the kind of the one that looked like a wolf.
Oh, right, yeah.
No, he was.
They were a great team. Well, anyway.
Their second best player was probably Krasimir Balakov.
Okay.
Who is now the manager of Bulgaria.
Oh, brilliant. Excellent. Well, who knows if years from now we won't be looking back on this Bulgaria team with such fond memories. For now, though, we're going to move on to... Oh, look, what else is going on in the countdown to 2020? Northern Ireland are top of their group, as we mentioned. They have had way more games than the other sides in that group, like Germany and Netherlands, but they've won all four of them so far, Michael O'Neill's side, and you can't say fairer than that. Will Grigg, not on fire at the moment for Sunderland, not actually in the squad. Chris Jones asks, any thoughts on Oliver Norwood retiring from international football at the age of 28 with 57 caps and home and away qualifiers against Germany and the Netherlands coming up?
Crying shame.
Well, I don't know the background to this, but it seems a strange timing, doesn't
it? Yeah, I was listening to some bits on the radio of people talking about this, because surely at 28 he is at peak prime time to be playing international football. If you're going to discuss Jamie Vardy not playing anymore, then this is a bigger topic, I think, the fact that Oliver Norwood's not. He's a huge miss, and I think he's shown that in his form this season. I don't understand it. I don't understand whether it was a no forever or whether
maybe
it was...
just doesn't fancy Germany and Netherlands come back after.
what's the reason? I'm unaware of this.
I think he wanted to focus on, club football, form. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. We'd all love to, Oliver, but we've got these international breaks. Yeah, what are you going to do?
Someone should have told him it's not at the same time. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. All right. Not top of their group, Wales, who are down in fourth. Ryan Giggs' side have won just one game so far in Group E. That was 1-0 against Slovakia. They've got Azerbaijan on Friday. Gareth Bale is fit. Ramsey obviously isn't. Harry Wilson, I believe, is very available. So feel kind of reasonably confident about their chances of getting a much-needed win.
Yeah, I think my game of the round is in that group, is Slovakia-Croatia, because Croatia lost to Hungary, just beat Azerbaijan 2-1 at home, and basically went there last year for a piece, and they are incredibly worried that all that World Cup goodwill is just being chucked away. And obviously they lost to England, which means they miss it. They don't even have the qualifier, the playoffs backup option. And yeah, if they lose to Slovakia, and as I say, they lost away in Hungary, then they're in big trouble.
Crikey. Scotland are also in some difficulty, although they do have that Nations League wildcard thing, but they're down in fourth and they're facing a huge game against Russia. Loads more on that in the Totally Scottish Football Show, where they'll also have Sesha Gurionov in with an expert view on this Scotland's opponents. Very nice. Ireland, meanwhile, under Mick McCarthy, of course, now are going very nicely. Top of their standings, with 3 wins and a draw so far. And they're taking on Switzerland, who are lying third in the group. And that's actually this evening, Thursday evening. So may have happened by the time you're hearing this, listener. It's something that most assuredly hasn't, and you're still very much in time for, and also concerns Ireland, is, Daniel...
Is it Totally Football Live?
It is. That's right. We can now confirm that we'll be making stops in both Dublin and Belfast in our Backstops Back Tour. Backstreet's back. At the start of November, we're going to be at Liberty Hall in Dublin on Friday the 8th of November. That's Friday the 8th of November. Meanwhile, Belfast Limerick will be hosting us on Saturday 9th, quite literally the next day. You can come to both because it's, you know.
You don't repeat the same topics.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that. I was just meaning it's quite easy. You just drive across.
People don't want to come and hear it all again.
Tickets are on sale now, and you can find links to those shows and our gigs in Liverpool and London. Crikey. At thetotallyfootballshow.com/events. Very good. Before we leave the Euro 2020 qualifiers, any other fixtures we should be getting excited about? Lindsay?
I am going, as the resident Wolves fan, I'm going to mention Portugal, of course, because they've got a lot of our players. So Portugal against Serbia. And at the moment, Portugal only have 2 points from 2 games. So it's interesting. But my fact about this match is that this game between Portugal and Serbia has never produced less than 2 goals or more than 3. So it either finishes 1-1 or 2-1.
Or 3-0.
That fixture.
I like the idea they've only played once and it was a 1-1 draw. That's what I'm hoping.
No, over time.
How many games have there been?
I mean, over time. I don't know how many games over time. I just know that that's a little stat about it.
Why is everyone saying that Portugal are in so much trouble? They've got terrific lineup. João Felix doing so well at Atletico Madrid, and him and Cristiano Ronaldo assuming that they link up well together. But they've had, what, a couple of draws so far, is it? Why is everyone saying, they're already in trouble?
I wouldn't say they're already in trouble, but they've had 2 home games and they've drawn them both. Portugal do have a habit of making qualification a little bit difficult for themselves. I just think this is one of the games where there's 2 teams who need a result, 2 exciting teams. So, of course, João Felix against Luka Jovic. Mm. They faced each other in the Europa League last year, Benfica against Eintracht. Of course, Jovic used to be at Benfica, so their fans were a little bit disappointed when he moved on, and João Felix kind of came in and filled that hole. So I just think it's, of all the fixtures that I don't have a vested interest in, it's maybe one I'll go out of my way to watch.
Okay.
This is the group, although they don't play this week, that Luxembourg are somehow second in with 4 points from 4 games. So, unfortunately,
4 points from 4 games, they're second.
Yeah. Portugal have only played twice for their 2
points.
Have they
drawn all their games or did they win one?
No, they won one, drawn one.
Who did they beat?
Lithuania, 2-1, yes.
Really?
Yeah, fair play.
All right. Excellent. Well, there's certainly all sorts of delights available across the broad spectrum of Euro qualifying. Up next, though, we're going to be talking about some other football that's taking place this weekend. It's the start of a brand new and biggest ever, best ever, Women's Super League season.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
WSL returns this weekend with a new sponsor, with a new TV deal. Viewers as far afield as Mexico, the Dominican Republic, Finland and Denmark will be able to follow the adventures of champions Arsenal, newly promoted Man United, Spurs, all those other sides.
As will you, James, as the FA player, because exactly. You can watch every single game live.
And you can, I think BBC are also putting it on the red button, is that right?
Yeah.
Brilliant, okay. So the opening fixtures, you're going along to Stamford Bridge on Sunday.
We are.
As Chelsea take on Spurs as part of this new thing of bringing women's game to venues traditionally associated with the men's version.
Yeah, and they seem to be doing quite well with ticket sales. So because that's the main concern, isn't it, when you bring women's football into these huge stadiums and they're used to potentially part filling something that's 4,000 or 5,000. You don't want to then be at Stamford Bridge or at the London Stadium or at the Etihad and it being feeling like it's pretty much empty. I mean, that was the concern, but it's not looking like that. It looks like there really is this pickup off the back of the World Cup. A lot of tickets have been sold.
How many?
We don't know at this stage the final amount, but I think they're looking at around, at Stamford Bridge, certainly over 20,000 will be there. But a lot of them as well, to entice a lot of families to come, have been given out free. So we need to remind people that if you have been given free tickets, to still go along, because I suppose that's the temptation when the weather maybe turns, but it is going to be worth going to go and see. It should be really good as well, because you're going to get to see some of the Lionesses from the summer. Fran Kirby will be playing. Beth England, who just got a call up for Chelsea, she's going to be playing. And then you look at Spurs, who are a pretty new outfit. They're the ones now trying to impress in this top division. And they've got Gemma Davison, who used to play for Chelsea, so there's a nice link there. She's a very skillful player, so she'll be playing. And Kit Graham, who they poached from Charlton, she might be getting amongst the goals. So it should be quite a competitive match, as well as being this nice spectacle at Stamford Bridge. You've got the Manchester United derby as well. So
that's on Saturday. A couple of games. Bristol City taking on Brighton, and United freshly up.
Yes, and I think Casey Stoney, you know, a lot of people getting overexcited because Manchester United ran away with the second tier so much last season. I think perhaps expectations she's trying to manage now, because she has lost a few players like Alex Greenwood, who's gone to Lyon. I mean, who refuses that in a move in women's football? But she has managed to get some great players. Abby McManus moved from Manchester City. She's got Jane Ross, who's now a new outlet for her up front. So there are new players. I think they're probably looking at a solid mid-table finish, I'd say, Man United this season. City, it's going to be interesting because no Nikita Paris for them. She went to Lyon because Lyon seemed to just take all the best players. So it's going to be interesting to see this jostle now for the top two Champions League places. You have to think that Arsenal are going to be contenders after winning last season to retain the title. Clearly, when you look at their squad as well, and they've got people like Jordan Nobbs returning from injury, Kim Little, who's an absolute superstar. So they're going to be difficult to stop. And I'd say Chelsea and City vying for that. And you mentioned Brighton and Bristol City. You know, maybe they need to be a bit wary, because down towards the bottom now is going to be interesting.
I see. So in terms of a title race, I think Arsenal, City, and who was it?
Chelsea, I would say, will be up there, yeah. And I also said to Kate on the podcast, we're doing a WSL edition on the offside rule, which we urge people to go and get the preview for this weekend, because we go through every single team.
So that's a new weekly edition of the offside rule. Only about WSL.
Only about WSL.
When's that coming out, Liz?
So it's out on Mondays. The preview edition's already out. So we go through every single team. We go through the England internationals as well, that we've just had some friendlies. So listen in for that. I did say to Kate, because she's a Liverpool fan, I do think Liverpool are the dark horses in the WSL this season. Mm. I think that they, having once toppled Arsenal, who dominated for so long, it was Liverpool who actually took the title off them eventually, had a good couple of years, and then sort of have gone a little bit forgotten. I think that this could be the season that they start to come back into it. And I would say they're my dark horses for this season.
Bold prediction. By the way, on the subject of friendlies, what a goal from Georgia Stanway.
Oh, yeah. But just a shame about the overall result.
Well, yeah. A 2-1 defeat to Norway.
It's fine, though, because we're lucky to have Phil Neville, and he is sticking around. So that's the...
Did you like those quotes?
I have a vision that nobody else has. I've got a bravery that no other coach has probably had. So do you know what? Thank you, lucky stars. I'm here. I'm here to stay. And I'm going to continue to keep improving. Hristo Stoichkov receiving his Ballon d'Or.
It feels like something he said in a hotel mirror to himself and then accidentally repeated in public.
Did he genuinely say this?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was in an interview, I think, with the Daily Telegraph.
Susie Rack, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's nice to see somebody so infused with positivity. You know, we talk about how sad it is when people are afflicted by depression, but as Phil himself says, I think we can go a long way. I live and breathe it, and I never have a bad day. That's something to celebrate.
The problem is that England haven't won in four games, which is their worst run for about 3.5 years. So.
Right. Hard to see what other options we've got at this point. Daniel, on the subject of the regular off, you know, the original brand offside rule, mm-hmm. are you doing something on footballing rivalries this week? Is that right?
Feuds, yes.
Feuds.
In football, yes.
Have you had to go back and re-record it on the basis of Michael Owen and Alan Shearer?
I think that inspired
extraordinary
it.
Extraordinary.
Wow, I know. And Steve Wilson got involved, didn't he? Commentator as
did
well.
He?
Yeah, did you see that?
Michael, have you got involved in this? Are you team Michael or team...
My suspicion is that Owen's details were incorrect.
Really? Alan Shearer wanting to move away?
Yeah, so this wasn't when Owen was at Newcastle.
Could you just give us a timeline for anyone who isn't sad enough to...
So he's talking about, he says when Shearer was at Newcastle under Robson.
But the problems begin with Michael's book, Michael Owen's book, where he says that going to Newcastle is something that he always regrets and that basically... Mm. He repeats some of the stuff he said on BT Sport.
He's always said it, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's been saying it for 10 years, yeah.
And I think he makes one or two comments about Alan Shearer as well. And Shearer then comes out and says, well, you were still holding down 120,000 a week or something.
He was turning up daily in training and leaving from training in a helicopter at that point. So I think it's fair to say he was making the most of the situation, which then led to that incredible Dubai video.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, listener, do. And that'll be the one good thing that comes out of this whole thing. But anyway, so they had a bit of a spat. And as you say, Steve Davis, I didn't see. What did he interject?
Steve Wilson, sorry.
Sorry.
Not Steve Davis.
As you say. So what did Steve Wilson do?
I think that he was just commenting on the fact that the book, you know, when people release parts on newspapers, serialization. Hmm. And I think that Michael just reacted to something that Steve had said or pulled him up on and basically said, when you see it in context, you will know. So we all will know when we read the book in context.
Brilliant.
No. But the North East-based journalist suggests that the chronology of that is not quite right. And actually, Shearer wasn't pushing for a move to Liverpool. I mean, my objection to that is, this. Owen's talking about a point where he wasn't at Newcastle.
Right.
He was at Liverpool at that time. So it's not like he has any inside knowledge of he might have heard murmurings from the club. But I just thought it was... I'm not sure he's right, basically.
Right.
But I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. I mean...
Oh, it's a funny one anyway, in that he's one of these players who was brilliant at a time for England, brilliant at a time for most clubs he played for, but is not remembered particularly fondly at any club. Liverpool fans don't really remember him too fondly because they prefer Robbie Fowler. Newcastle fans really don't. Even Manchester United fans don't. Real Madrid fans barely remember him.
Yeah, it's not
just
really
kind of a strange legacy he's got.
Very popular in Dubai,
fans,
of course.
Stoke fans absolutely love him.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll move on now. Still to come, we'll be dipping into our bulging sack of mail. And there's one or two things in there, I think. And also a very, very exciting flip reverse. First, though, here's producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jembo, and a very happy International Week. Listeners, I've got Lee Price from Paddy Power on the line. Lee, let's start by talking about England and Bulgaria. Give us some markets on this one, please.
Yeah, just as I got used to Premier League being back, it's back to England time. Good news, though. They're 1-20 to win this match. The draw is 10-1, or Bulgaria, massive 25-1 outsiders. As for goal scorers, Mr. Kane is 4-11, odds on to score. Various other players who might make their bow. James Maddison, 2-1 to score any time. Mason Mount, 2-1 to score any time. Or Mings on his debut, 13-2, if he gets on the pitch, of course. And one final one for you here, 9-2 that Harry Kane wins a penalty. No comment.
And what are you guys making for the Scotland-Russia game?
This is one of the closest matches in our betting for the International Week. Scotland are 7-4, Russia 8-5, making the visitors the very, very slight favourites. 15-8 for the draw. Scotland could really do with a win.
We've been hearing from Rafa and Mikael Jongsma about the rivalry between Germany and Holland. Give us some numbers on this one, please.
I don't know if I've done something wrong here, but I'm quite surprised by the odds. Probably just me, to be fair. It's 10 to 11 that Germany win this one. Odds on, despite the last few games between these teams being very, very close. Holland are 5-2 and sound like value to me, or the draw is 13-5. Either way, should be a great game to watch.
And finally, what are the odds, please, on Spain hitting double figures against the Faroe Isles?
Now, this is a game I could be confident predicting. Spain are an incredible 1-80 to win. Although, is it really that incredible? Faroe Islands, 125-1 to win. And God, I'd love it if they did. More likely, in fact, five times more likely, is that Spain hit double figures. It's 25-1. They score 10 or more goals. That'd be brutal.
You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Now, let's have a look. Who sent us a missive? Oh, here's Philip Benton, who says, can we have a new flip and reverse it? Perhaps, says Philip, perhaps one which means Bury survive. That would be nice, wouldn't it? But no, that's not what you've done, is it?
No, I've ignored that very wholesome suggestion.
He's trying to get right. Retweets or something.
Yeah.
So
could have one where World War II didn't happen.
So I mean, that's very valid.
Yeah, I suppose. The no Christmas truce match, though, so football would lose out in World War One.
What, if it was World War One?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But what you've done is actually a question that, to be fair, it's not the one that Philip's asking, but it is one that has been raised by many people.
I suppose it has, yes.
It has, in recent weeks. What would have happened if Alexis Sanchez had gone to Manchester City instead of Manchester United? Take it away, Alexis. January the 15th, 2018. A more innocent time when Theresa May was Prime Minister. Ed Sheeran was number one with Perfect. And Pep Guardiola formally announced that City were ending their pursuit of Arsenal's Alexis Sanchez. Dog lover Alexis was having a so-so season with the Gunners, having scored 7 goals in 19 games. He'd made it known he wanted to go to a club that would challenge for the title. The City board decided that the pooch-preferring players' wage demands were too high, though, and would cause a ruckus in their squad, so they let him go to United, who were on their way at the time to finishing second under Jose Mourinho. In the end, the chum of K9's Chilean was given a contract worth about $390,000 a week, with 75,000 bonus for every first team start and loads of goal and assist bonuses, which, to be fair, remained very much in the realms of the hypothetical. But had that swap deal with Mkhitaryan not gone through and he gone to join Pep instead, what world will we be living in now, Daniel Storey?
So I think, City go on to win the league that season, and that's undoubted. They were far enough clear. He was signed ostensibly for the Champions League. I'm not sure he makes a difference in the fairly emphatic eventually defeat to Liverpool. So I think that season at City stays as it is. I would suggest maybe that City don't win the league last season and that Liverpool do, because the Sanchez signing at the time came off the back of some pretty significant doubts about Sergio Aguero's ability to adapt to Pep Guardiola football. And the potential was that he would either play as this left-sided forward and therefore Raheem Sterling's place might suffer, or as a central striker, which he'd been doing at Arsenal for a bit, and Sergio Aguero's place might suffer, and they were two brilliant cogs in City's machine last season. So I think it's probably fair to say that might not have happened. The knock-on effects are Riyad Mahrez certainly doesn't go to City,
right?
Because they are hamstrung by those wages. And Guardiola has even said it would have damaged us if we'd have signed Sanchez at that money. Also, he said that Kevin De Bruyne and Raheem Sterling would probably have kicked up a bit more of a fuss for their new deals in terms of the amount of money they'd have wanted. And certainly, I think Leroy Sané would probably have been sold to make up that shortfall.
So essentially, he would have weakened Man City quite.
Yeah, I think Guardiola said that, and I think that's probably true. This idea that Sanchez was a flop at Manchester United, but would have been brilliant at City, I don't really buy into, because he looked in that half season at Arsenal like he'd played too much football, and I think that was the case.
Okay.
Now, in this scenario, can we also pretend that there's a swap deal?
Yeah.
At play? You know, who's going from Man City? Who are they losing? And what does that do for Arsenal?
Right. Arsenal don't get Mkhitaryan.
Well, I think Arsenal would have probably bought Riyad Mahrez from Leicester because he wouldn't have gone to City.
Right.
But I think the more interesting issue is at Manchester United.
Sorry, Lindsay.
Sorry. I think
the more interesting issue,
I think, is at Man United, because I think if they finish second and Mourinho is allowed to spend the money they did spend on Sanchez on a centre-back that he wanted, potentially Virgil van Dijk or Harry Maguire a year earlier, and then bought a wide player that he wanted, I think they would probably have finished in the top four, and Mourinho could very feasibly still be Man United manager.
And the good thing is, with the money they didn't spend on Sanchez wages, they got it and they saved Bury, didn't they? So...
So in a way, you've
very
answered
much
the question.
And shakers.
Yeah,
that's extraordinary. You know, I thought that was going to be quite a simple answer, but it was anything but.
Sorry.
I guess the lesson there is that if you go back and you meddle with even the smallest piece of the, you know, of,
what
of,
was that
of chronology,
and if producer Ben gives you 2 days to prepare for an answer, then
right,
you will really,
oh dear, really
dive
do
into
you have a heads
it.
Up
yeah,
on that?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice. So basically, Arsenal, and do we ever answer Lindsay's question about who do Arsenal get? They get Riyad Mahrez.
I think Arsenal get Riyad Mahrez,
and
may
what
well
to Mkhitaryan then. I mean, he goes to Italy a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, exactly. He goes to Napoli rather than Roma or something.
See, I thought you might have said that, you know, maybe they got Sane as part of a swap or something.
Well, the story was, at the time, was that City offered Raheem Sterling as part of a swap deal for Alexis Sanchez. That was the summer before.
Still?
Which would have been very interesting, because I think it's fair to say that Sterling is a player more than any other who has benefited from being at Manchester City rather than at a club like Arsenal.
Right. Sanchez, by the way, in what we term reality, scored a grand total of 3 goals. 3 for Man United. That's the same number as Daniel James has already got this season. Bonkers.
I think he'll score a lot this season for...
Daniel James?
No, Sanchez.
Oh, what, for
Conte.
Inter?
Yeah, yeah.
What was C? Thanks, Daniel. And thanks, Blazing Squad, as well. So, Adam Chandler and his question here, or statement, rather, Inter's ultras and their statement to Lukaku, discuss. This follows last Sunday's events in the game between Cagliari and Inter when... audible monkey chants are directed at Romelu Lukaku as he steps up to take a penalty that wins the game for Inter. There's been widespread outcry and dismay at this, another example of racism from Cagliari fans. Surprisingly, or perhaps not that surprisingly, but curiously, Cagliari's supporters were defended this week by the Inter Milan ultras. It's not who issued essentially their group from the Curva Nord, the voice of the North, issued a statement in which they said, have we all read it here? Mm. If you haven't listened, I mean, that the key things are that it's explaining to Romelu Lukaku, it's addressed to Lukaku, and it says, it's astonishingly patronising. It says, we understand it could have seemed racist to you, but it's not like that. In Italy, we use some ways to help our teams and try and make our opponents nervous. Not for racism, but to mess them up. We're not racist, and so are not the Cagliari fans. This is their English version of the statement. And the other extraordinary thing, after the essentially telling him, by the way, comparing players to apes is not racist, is that they say, when you declare, Lukaku, that racism is a problem to be fought in Italy, you're just helping the repression against all football fans, including us, and you contribute to create a problem that is not really there. I mean, I struggle.
It's
really,
it's a good exercise in victim blaming, isn't it?
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. I mean, that has long been a facet of Italian support, that they feel that, or elements of the Tifosi feel that anything goes in terms of putting off a player, anything
also,
you can throw at them.
But also, it's just ignorance as to knowing what racism is.
Yeah. I mean, some people would say only a racist could possibly say that wasn't racist. And yeah, that's an interesting conversation to have. I think it's really disappointing that, as far as I can see so far, Inter themselves haven't taken a position on this statement. As I say, it's not one from Inter themselves, but it's from one of their fans groups who release statements and press releases in this way in Italy quite often. Cagliari themselves, I mean, they have actually condemned their fans' approach, and hopefully some action is going to be taken by the Federation. But
it needs to be. I mean, this is four times.
The disciplinary judge, the league judge, that obviously in Serie A, a person goes and looks through every game and decides if any disciplinary action should take place, didn't use the word racist in his summation of the game. He said it was chants that have received media attention, was how he phrased it, I think, in the translation. So it doesn't bode particularly promisingly for any action to be taken.
And certainly nothing's really happened to Cagliari in the past. When
no,
saw this with,
not at all.
Well, Moise Kean last season.
And with Balotelli and Mentari and right the way back, they've never had action taken against them as a club.
part of the issue, I think, is that in Italy there is this notion that if we just kind of, if we just ignore them, I mean, the ultras are just kind of badly behaved and maybe they'll catch up with the rest of society eventually. And to be fair, the ultras are often really, really positive organisations. Mm. I mean, they do some incredibly, well, not just in terms of the choreography and the whole kind of folklore of the Italian game, but some of them are incredibly socially aware and woke, if you want to use that expression, and do great, great, great things and also provide a framework of solidarity and even a voice for the fan in a game in which, you know, in the modern game in which obviously the fans are struggling to have any kind of weight in decision making. So in that sense, the ultras often do positive things. This, though, is really, really depressing.
But they kind of have the power to release statements like this because the league hasn't taken action before. So the league is effectively, overtly or implicitly, is saying, well, yeah, that's right. You know, anything is allowed because they haven't taken any action when they've done it before. So why would they not do it? Keep doing it?
Mm.
And obviously, people like Carlo Tavecchio, who has been a president of the Italian Football Federation, and you know, he's talking about things like players eating bananas before coming to Italy, and he was the president for 3 years. So yeah, it's not as if this isn't entrenched in the culture all over.
Mm. The thing I find extraordinary is even if the people in power have no interest in tackling racism, these people are so obsessed with the brand of their leagues. They must understand that if I were to ask my friends, you know, what the score was of Napoli Juve, they might not know, but everyone will have seen this. And it just puts people off the thing that they're trying to promote. And if that seems like the only way that you can get these people to listen these days.
Yeah.
But they're not even going with that. I just find it extraordinary that they have no interest in taking any action.
Yeah, well, really unfortunate for Romelu Lukaku and hopefully his presence there and will help to shed a little light into the brains of some of these people, a little understanding in. Thanks, Adam Chandler, for that question. In other tweets news, the Sausage König asked for information about the statistical basis for the notion that 2-0 is a dangerous scoreline. And this, unfortunately, sparked one of those kind of Michael Owen, Alan Shearer-esque Twitter beefs between our very own Michael Cox.
And, who have you been feuding with?
Duncan Alexander, who was trying to bully you with numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
He'll do that, won't he?
Yeah, well, my objection, first of all, is I think the original phrase was 2-0 is a dangerous lead.
Right.
Not the most dangerous. It was like, don't switch off. We've all seen you can go 2-0 up, feel comfortable, concede two goals. Then it got changed to the most dangerous lead, which is clearly not the case.
And then I think also my reaction to Duncan's numbers. I mean, he comes up with the all-time Premier League numbers up until the end of last season for teams who were two goals up, and only 2.7 of those matches have then gone on to see that team defeated.
But that's a silly stat to use. It shouldn't be just defeat, it should be draw as well.
Right.
If you're 2-0 up and you drew 2-2-all, that's evidence of a 2-0 lead being dangerous.
Akin to Chelsea and Sheffield United last week.
And Arsenal and Tottenham. So it's happened 20% of the time within the last 10 Premier League games.
I would suggest that even a game like Juve-Napoli last week, which saw Juve taking a 3-0 lead, effectively then consider their job done, get caught out by Napoli to the tune of three goals and suddenly find themselves heading towards a 3-3 draw. They went on to win it through an own goal by Napoli's Koulibaly, but that was still danger. So even though that doesn't figure in Duncan's stats, I'm afraid the numbers here, they don't tell the whole story. It's essentially unbelievably dangerous to go two goals up and to be avoided wherever possible.
Whilst you're talking about Juventus,
right,
I noticed that Emre Can, so he's not in the Champions League squad.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Ooh.
Well, I think that goes back to what we were talking about at the top, where the rich clubs have assembled very large sets of players, probably on the assumption that at a certain point they'd be able to move the surplus ones on, but turns out they're all full.
And it's not as if Juventus picked any surprises to leave out Emre Can, really. It's just they have too many players, isn't it?
Right.
But I read an interview with him on international duty where he said, well, once I'm back from duty, I need to have a word. I mean, what's he going to say?
Well, no, but his position is that he was told when he decided not to move away, which is the curious thing about this, because it wasn't like he was one of the ones that they were trying to get rid of, but he was told, no, stay with us because you've got Champions League football.
Oh.
And so you can understand. I mean, if that's what genuinely happened, that's certainly his position. You can understand his frustration to then find that actually he doesn't.
And also, it's funny because he's the exact kind of player you try and squeeze into your squad because he can play anywhere, can't he?
Fair.
I thought that too. I thought surely he would.
They've
he would be
strikers,
good to have
they,
in your squad.
Yeah.
They leave out Mandzukic as well.
Yes. Which is, well, I think there's
that's because of January
his commitment
transfer,
to
yeah.
you know the Sarri project
it's
going
a shame.
Forward.
He's so many Champions League moments over the years.
Man United have been linked with him and West Ham, haven't they?
They were the transfer window
for, no, but for January. For January. I know we're talking about the next transfer window already.
Are we already?
Yeah.
Crikey. Ollis wants to talk about the best sports books that each of the panel have read, not including any they've written themselves.
Okay.
But Daniel, you can do Michael.
I don't know, he's going first. I don't trust him.
Michael.
A best sports book I've read this year, if I can say that, is a book called Full Gas by Peter Cossins, which is about the tactical development of road cycling. And it's absolutely brilliant.
Brilliant.
It just splits everything into great great chapters, but categorises the different stages.
Right.
And there's just... I'm a really big cycling fan, but there's so many things I had never considered about it, and it's brilliant.
Oh, that's interesting.
You'd probably like it. You're into cycling, aren't you?
I am. I like a bit of cycling. I think one of my favourite sporting books, apart from people who've written in this room,
of course,
was Tyler Hamilton's book.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it was amazing.
That was brilliant.
The title of which is...
Oh, I can't remember, but it won the...
It's not Racing Through the Dark, because that's David Miller's, isn't it? Which is also good, but Tyler Hamilton's is extraordinary.
Tyler Hamilton's was very good.
There's certain sports that are good for sports. Books and cycling is up there.
Oh, producer Abby, who's in for producer Ben this week, says Secret Racer. Secret Race, says
the
producer.
I mean, as this is a football podcast, I'll give two football shouts. First is The Bible, which is The Ball is Round by David Goldblatt, which is a bit of a textbook, really. It's about 1,000 pages.
I thought for a second you were genuinely going to say The Bible. And then I was going to say.
Best of the Bible.
What are your favourite bits?
Old Testament.
I don't want to discuss
the same, The Miracle of Castel de Sangro is the one, really. Is that kind of romantic tale.
And why he hasn't done a follow-up book,
because
that place,
I feel like I'm going to lower the tone with my suggestion.
Is Frank Lampard's Magic Boots? Or
No, but I think given that it's a week where Ray Parler has had a book come out.
Has he?
Yes. I thought we'd go for rock bottom toilet humour.
What's Ray's book called?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head.
Is it called Parlour Talk or something?
I promise you it'll be called It's Only Ray Parlour. I'm almost certain it'll be called that.
He had a book that came out like 3 years ago that was called that.
There we go.
On that general theme, I would say if you like your toilet humour, if you like real bottom of the... like a toilet book, really, one that you read in the bog, I would go with Paul Merson.
Oh, I thought it was
and his autobiography.
It
is hilarious.
Is it?
It is absolutely hilarious, but probably not very highbrow.
No, yes.
I'm just looking at the Rom for Pelé : It's Only Ray Parler's Autobiography. Yeah, that was came out in 2016, but there's no word
There's a new book.
While you're having a look for that, here's a question from Guts8 Gary, and I found this very interesting, actually. Guts8 asks, I've always wanted to know, what does a manager of a big club, say a Liverpool, Juve or Real Madrid, do during international week, given that all of his players are going to be away for 10 days? Logic suggests working on fine-tuning and training, but how can you with none of your first 11 and bench? It's a very good point, isn't it? What do they do? Does anybody know?
I'm not sure there's an interesting answer for that, other than they make do with what they can with the players around.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, in terms of, he says fine-tuning, but that's a vague term anyway, in that there isn't an awful lot of fine-tuning to do once the season begins. It's about training the players you have. So I guess they do exactly the same, but with the players they have.
So breaking Ray Parler news, it came out on the 5th of May. It's Only Ray Parler's. So it's
broken.
It came out in May.
That's an old one.
But what have they done then? Have they done
audiobook?
I think it's paperback.
Yeah. I think this is audiobook.
You can't have another book. You bought one out like 3 years ago. No, I read that like 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. Well, he's been talking about it again this week.
You read it?
He has. Yeah.
How would you rate that in your top 10 football books?
I wouldn't feature in the top 10.
Okay, but in terms of tell-all players' autobiographies, would it feature in that? What's your favourite tell-all players' autobiography?
Favourite autobiography is a good question, I think.
Okay.
That is a good question.
I would say... Oh, you go.
I think the best one I've read in recent years is Craig Bellamy's autobiography.
Oh, I bet that's interesting.
It's got a good title, hasn't it? Is it Goodfellas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I found interesting because I read a hell of a lot of footballers' autobiographies for one of the books I did. Basically, any book ghostwritten by Oliver Holt is very good.
Paul McGrath's is.
Right.
Not as for football reasons necessarily, but yeah, Paul McGrath's is a heck of a read.
Okay. Well, there's some reading for you, listener. That brings us, though, to the end of today's show. Many thanks to Lindsay. to Daniel and to Michael for being with us. Daniel, you're actually going to be coming along to the Fantasy Football, the official Fantasy Premier League podcast, which will be out Thursday night, Friday morning, and then you're back on Monday as well.
The crikey. Quick hat trick, Robbie Fowler versus Arsenal.
Exactly. Frida Fagerlund and Jack Lang, high-flying in fantasy terms, Jack Lang. Do you know he's number one in his country?
Yeah, because he's put his country down as the Holy See.
Well, because he thought of it. Anyone could have done that, Dan.
There's about 10 people who have put that, isn't there?
Well, he's beaten all of them, so far anyway. What are you up to this weekend, Lindsay? You're going across to that.
So I'm going to Stamford Bridge and I'm moving house.
Oh, wow.
So Stamford Bridge on Sunday, moving house on Monday.
Good luck with that. Yeah. Michael?
I'm going to Sussex against Worcestershire in the T20 Blast. Then I'm going to Whitehawk against Abbey Rangers. Keep an eye out on The Athletic for a special feature on that.
Brilliant. Whitehawk from Brighton.
How did you know that?
Well, because I remember them. They had a cup run, didn't they?
They did have a cup run.
Yeah.
You know what Whitehawk was also the site of?
It's a brutal area of an already rough town, isn't it?
Half of that is true, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Brighton's quite a pleasant place. But Whitehawk's the kind of
it was also the scene
edgier.
Of, yeah, it was also the scene of that You've Got No Fans rant.
Was it?
Yeah. Spoilt the intro to
Do
my
Do you want some?
Article. Yeah, yeah.
Because I'll give it you.
Yeah. So the thing that gets the bloke riled up is the bloke going, "Them Yorks are playing well," and he objects to that.
Well, to play us out then today, let's just enjoy the Dulcet Tones of the Wealdstone Raider, and we'll see you all for another Totally Football Show on Monday.
I'm the Wealdstone Raider. You might know who I am. 'Cause after all the fans, some of these rappers have got no tunes and no fans. That's why I'm here, the Wealdstone Raider.
Wealdstone Raider, Wealdstone Raider, Wealdstone Raider.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter, and make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.